A History of Ancient Sparta, Lecture 6, Women in Sparta.
In our previous lectures, we talked about distinctive Spartan customs, the position of women in Sparta, the Spartan army, the legendary agoge, or upbringing, and so forth. And we also charted, at least briefly, the early history of Sparta, Mycenaean Sparta, the problems in the Dark Ages, the various controversies surrounding the invasion of the Dorians, Plutarch's Life of Lycurgus, and Plutarch's account, whether Lycurgus was a historical figure or not, of the development of Spartan institutions, and perhaps most importantly, at least in determining the ultimate shape of Spartan society, the institution of helotage, or the enslavement, if you will, of the helots, first in the Helos Plain at the southern end, at the mouth of the valley of the Eurotas in Laconia, and then, more significantly, more far-reaching, sometime shortly before or perhaps after 700 BCE, the conquest of Messenia, the valley of the Pamisos River and environs over Mount Tegidos, immediately to the west of Laconia itself, the so-called First Messenian War, according to the Spartan poet Tyrtaeus, overseen in large part by King Theopompus, the foundation of the Ephorit, the rise to power of the five ephors who were annually selected, the land distribution which assured that Spartan citizens each, at least in theory and in actual practice as well, had their own kleros, or land allotment farmed by helots, which enabled them to pay their dues to the syssitia, or the common mess, where they ate pretty much all of their adult lives. And finally, very important, sometime toward the end of the first quarter of the 7th century, that is to say, sometime around 675, the introduction in Sparta of the phalanx. That is, again, a military arrangement by which heavily armed with shield, helmet, spear, the distinctive Spartan very short sword, the better to close in, so the Spartans are reputed to have said. This long line of heavily armed infantrymen, each holding a spear in the right hand and the heavy shield hoplon or aspis in the left, which guarded not only the warrior himself, but also the man next to him. They were very close to each other, as the fact that the shield was guarding, in effect, two people would suggest. Ordinarily, or very often, lined up about eight deep, several hundred across, a unique mode of fighting, which Victor Davis Hanson, years ago, in his first major book, argued led to a distinctive Western way of war, seeking decisive once-and-for-all conflict. Be that as it may, it proved very effective for the Spartans, and well so, because sometime around 670 and going on through 650, they faced a very major challenge, which was in many respects as determinative of their institutions and character as the original conquest of Messenia and the institution of helotage. And that was the so-called Second Messenian war when the Messenian helots revolted, and it took Sparta the better part of 20 years, so far as can be told. We're still before we have really reliable records, or any really recent records other than the poems of Tyrtaeus and a few others. Nonetheless, it was a very major challenge to Sparta under the reign of Anaxander or Anaxandros, depending on how you want to specify it, which the Spartans finally, though with difficulty, managed to win. Having secured then the valley of Laconia and the valley of Messenia, the Spartans then, in the 7th century, decided that it might be a good idea to see if they could impose their sway further afield, and decided that they would advance, if they could, to the north and reduce at least the nearest of the Arcadians to helotage as well. The Spartans, being the pious folks that they were, decided that they had best consult the oracle at Delphi, about their plans before they undertook them, and Herodotus reports the reply of the Pythia, which goes as follows. "For Arcadia, you ask me. You ask for much. I refuse to give it. Eaters of acorns," by the way, just as a note to help you in your reading of classical literature, eaters of acorns live in the Golden Age, all but by definition. This is actually a very positive sign, in case you ever wondered. However, at least the acorns I have tried have to be boiled, or they're pretty unappetizing. After that, I'm told they're nutritious, though I have never ventured far enough to be able to say for sure. Nevertheless, Arcadia, unsurprisingly, I suppose, was full of eaters of acorns, and many of them dwell in Arcadia, and they will stop you. But not all will I grudge you. To Gia, I will give you a dance floor to tread, a beautiful plain to measure out with a line." Well, the Spartans thought, you know, part is better than nothing. So they set off to conquer Gia, according to Herodotus, bringing shackles with them to shackle the Tegeans who they captured, who they were about to make into helots. Unfortunately, things did not turn out the way the Spartans expected. They were captured, they were defeated, and the Spartan warriors, or some of them themselves, were placed in the shackles, and according to Herodotus, some centuries later, quote, "those shackles are still, even in my day, hanging safe in Tegea around the temple of Athena Aleia." Well, the phalanx, I guess, early on did not always work. Not only did it not always work at this juncture, in any case, against the Arcadians, it also failed to work against the Pallas, which would, over the years, turn out to be Sparta's bitterest and most consistent, if not finally most effective, Hellenic enemy, and that is the sister Peloponnesian city of Argos. They were contesting a region on the coast, effectively between Argos and Laconia, at the battle, as it's called, of Hesiae, which was yet another loss for Sparta, which so exercised them that for years later they commemorated the battle as a way of focusing their attention. Well, the Spartans were discouraged at this point in the early mid-600s by their lack of success against their nearby Peloponnesian opponents, and consulting the oracle again, they were led to believe that they would have better success if they could bring the bones of Orpheus to Sparta, which they succeeded in doing, by trick, bought them in, and thereafter, happily for the Spartans, things went much better. The bones of Orpheus, this is an interesting sidelight too, and other heroic bones were evidently the bones of mammoths or mastodons, which had been partially fossilized or in any case buried. The idea was that the heroes of generations before the present were big guys, and the bones of a mastodon or a mammoth would certainly fill the bill if you were looking for the bones of big guys. Well, in any case, they were successful in finding the bones of Orpheus, brought them home, and thereafter, things evidently began to go better and better and better for them. It was pretty nearly another century before, at least so far as we have records, the Spartans felt able to take on Argos again, but in 545 they did so in the excitingly named Battle of the Champions, fought, so we're told, at Thriatis, which is very near, in fact, where the Battle of Hesiae had been fought. Evidently a bone of contention area more than a century before. This time, the Spartans and the Argives, so Herodotus informs us, decided that they would pit 300 picked champions from each side against each other to fight it out, the winner getting the contested area. And after what must have been a gruesome day of battle, there were, so we are told, three folks left. Alcaenor and Chromius, a bit the worse for the wear on the Argive side, and only one, Othorades, on the Spartan side. Well, Alcaenor and Chromius went back to Argos to report their victory, reportedly. Othorades stayed where he was, stripped the Argive dead, and maintained possession of the field, and by the rules of the game, so to speak, in place at the time, he was determined to be the winner. And henceforward, for a long time, Sparta had the upper hand over Argos. In 420, it should be noted, again, well more than a century later, the Argives offered to renew the battle, 300 apiece, but that time the Spartans, confident of their powers, turned them down. Meanwhile, the project of helotizing all of the Peloponnese proving a little bit more difficult, perhaps, than they had anticipated, the Spartans adopted another and ultimately a far more successful course, at least with regard to the Peloponnese as a whole, and that is seeking allies in what came to be known ultimately as the Peloponnesian League. Corinth was perhaps over the years Sparta's most reliable ally, which has always seemed a bit surprising to me. I mean, if Sparta is a byword, among other things, for austerity, Corinth, think of the letter of Paul to the Corinthians, was a byword for luxury and commercial prosperity, and at least at some times and under some conditions for licentiousness. Nevertheless, they remained faithful allies most of the time. They were both, however, Dorian in ancestry, and that may well have had something to do with it. Shortly thereafter, shortly after about 525, Elis, which is where Olympia is in the northwest Peloponnese, also allied, and gradually Sparta built up the League of Allies. They were unequal treaties, Sparta being dominant in all cases, very dominant early on, somewhat less dominant as time progressed, but always dominant, at least to some degree. Sparta built up a group of allies in the Peloponnesian League, which formed the basis, when the time came, for the Hellenic alliance, which successfully resisted the would-be incursions of the Persian Empire. And the reason that Sparta, not as we are generally inclined to believe, Athens, but technically and in substantial measure in actual fact, the reason that Sparta led the alliance against Persia was in large part because Sparta was the leader of the already existing and formidable Peloponnesian League. Meanwhile, events elsewhere began to get pretty interesting, and began to get interesting in ways which would soon impact all Hellas and the Spartans in particular. In 560 or thereabouts, King Croesus acceded to the throne in Lydia. Lydia was in what is now southwest Turkey and was a prosperous region. The phrase rich as Croesus is a reference to the proverbial wealth of King Croesus of Lydia, and indeed his kingdom, among other innovations, was the first to introduce coinage, so far as we know, anywhere in the world about this time. There were also an array of Ionian Greeks settled along the coast of what is now Turkey, along the Aegean coast, and many of them were more or less content as subjects of Croesus. Croesus, however, as his reign progressed, became worried about the growing power of a threat a bit to the east of him. Cyrus, beginning about 550, was in the process of founding, in effect, of consolidating what became the Persian Empire, which would become the largest, both in terms of population, I would think, and certainly in terms of land area control, the largest empire which had existed up to this time. And as Near Eastern empires of ancient times go, a relatively benign one. Croesus perceived this, rightly, as a threat and began casting about for allies. And among the allies he sought were prominently Sparta. He sent ambassadors, according to Herodotus, who gave the following message to the Spartans. Croesus, king of the Lydians and other peoples, sent us here with this message. This shortly after 550, after Cyrus had begun to make his presence known. Lacedaemonians, the god's oracle told me to acquire the Hellene as a friend and a supporter. He was a big believer, Croesus was, in the Delphic oracle. You, I have learned, are the leaders of Hellas, and so I invite you to comply with the oracle. I am eager to become your friend and military ally without treachery or guile. Well, the Spartans were responsive to that proposal, even though they had not engaged at that point in any military action outside of Hellas, not in any significant military action outside of the Peloponnese, but they went along with it, and indeed, about 546, sent an embassy to Cyrus, who said that Cyrus was not to inflict any reckless damage on any city, including any Lydian city, in Hellenic territory, because, quote unquote, the Lacedaemonians would not tolerate it. To which, we are told, Cyrus replied, who are the Lacedaemonians and who are the Spartans? He had evidently never heard of them and thought it a little bit presumptuous of them to be attempting to dictate policy for him, and went on to say that he had never yet taken advice from people who spent their day in the marketplace trying to swindle each other. Which actually the Spartans were not so remarkable for, but other Greeks perhaps more so, at least from a Persian perspective. Well, Croesus, meanwhile, and famously, had consulted the Delphic Oracle about the probable results of his launching a preemptive strike against Persia. And he was told in perhaps the most famously ambiguous oracular response of all time, if you do that, a great empire will fall. Croesus, of course, presumed that meant that he would conquer Persia. The result turned out to be no, not that, but the opposite. Persia conquered him. The Spartans, true to their word, reportedly did have an embassy on the way to help Croesus at the time he was conquered, but not for the first time or the last. They were a little bit late in getting started, and before they could intervene effectively or no, they got word that Croesus had fallen and there was no point in completing their mission. One result of the victory of Silence was to place many Ionian Greeks under Persian rather than Lydian control. And while there were many empires which were more oppressive than Persia, nonetheless, the Ionian Greeks would have preferred to be on their own. And this, in time, would lead to a sequence of events which finally ensued in what we think of as Herodotus' great subject, the Persian Wars. Meanwhile, though, events in Sparta were unfolding in complex and interesting ways. The Agaid senior king of Sparta, Anaxandridas II, had married, as Spartans often did, for sexual attraction or for love, and was extremely fond of his wife. But she thus far, and for an extended period of time, proved barren, and the ephors ordered him to divorce her. The ephors did have power over kings, as we discussed when talking about Spartan government, had power over kings, at least in some conditions, but he refused. He loved his wife and would not divorce her and marry somebody else who would presumably be fertile. So the ephors consulted further and said, okay, we're not big on bigamy, but here's the deal. You can remain married to your wife, but you have to marry somebody else because we've got to have an heir. That he did, and gave birth shortly. His second wife, his new wife, gave birth shortly to a man by the name of Cleomenes. Thereafter, however, his original wife suddenly began producing sons and had in succession Dorius, Leonidas, and Cleombrotus, several of whom will loom large in our subsequent discussion. Well, about 520, Anaxandridas died. And Dorius, the eldest son of the favored wife, anticipated that he would become the Agaid Spartan king. That did not happen. Instead, the choice went to the eldest, Cleomenes, and Dorius, in more or less a fit of frustrated temper, departed from Sparta with presumably his faction and his followers and first attempted to found Sparta's second ever overseas colony in North Africa. That didn't work out, and then went on to try to found another colony in Sicily, and eventually got himself killed. Cleomenes, meanwhile, ruled, and he was a powerful and interesting and influential king, as we will see. Cleomenes, though, failed to produce a son either. His only child, or at least his only surviving child, was Gorgo. Interesting name. It really does mean Gorgon. You remember from mythology the Gorgon Medusa, who was so hideously ugly with her snaky hair that to look at her turns you to stone. Gorgo was evidently named more with a view to sounding formidable than to sounding attractive, though in fact she evidently was both. We've already cited several quotations from her and instances of her intelligence and character, both as an advisor to her father, even as a young girl, and finally as the wife of Leonidas, the second son of Anaxandridas's favored first wife. Meanwhile, strange things were going on in the junior Eurypontid house in Sparta. King Ariston married a woman, his third wife, as it happened, whom we have already discussed, and that was the young girl who was hideously ugly, according to report, so much so, again, that her parents couldn't bear to look at her, and was taken by her helot nurse to the shrine of Helen, where the helot nurse prayed on the young girl's behalf, we don't know her name, that she would become beautiful. And Helen, or at any rate a appropriately beautiful female apparition, reportedly appeared, and miraculously, this very, very ugly little girl grew up to be the most beautiful woman in Sparta, and as such, she attracted the attention of Ariston, the Eurypontid king, who married her, and 7 months later, by report, was surprised by the arrival of a child, who became King Demaratus. He caused some trouble for himself, however, and opened a door to the machinations of Cleomenes by, when first hearing that his wife had given birth 7 months after the marriage, claiming, "The baby couldn't be mine. That's too quick." Women in Sparta knew better than that, that there were plenty of early births, but the men evidently didn't, or didn't consistently, and didn't bother to consult. And so, Demaratus, though he did ascend to the throne, had his parentage to some degree under a cloud, which would ultimately come to cost him fairly dearly. Meanwhile, events were bubbling along on the Aegean coast of Turkey sometime around 525. Sparta and Corinth mounted an expedition to attempt to oust Polycrates, the tyrant of Samos, an island and a powerful island, a big island, right off the Aegean coast of Turkey. Polycrates of Samos also was reportedly the first person since the mythical days of King Minos of Crete to mount a thalassocracy, that is a substantial international power based on a navy, based in this case on various forms of war galleys. And again, about 8 years later, in 517, there was another call for help from Samos. This time, the Spartans refused, but they were being consistently involved in events right on the edge of Persian influence, or indeed within the realm of Persian influence, and seemed to have some kind of special relationship with Samos in particular. A major Greek institution among aristocratic folks was what's called xenia, which is translated as guest friendship. Our own term, xenophobe, someone who's afraid of foreigners, comes from xenos, guest friend or foreigner, not a friend, and phobos, fear. The Spartans seem to have some kind of institutionalized or quasi-institutionalized, fairly far-reaching series of xenia relationships with Samos. So the relations there were perhaps surprisingly close. This too would have implications for the future. Finally, over the last years of the 6th century, 506, 504, and so forth, the Peloponnesian League really crystallized into a more or less firmly and coherently organized institution. This, too, would be important for the future. The first Peloponnesian League Congress was in 506, supposedly, and Spartan dominance was to some degree checked by 504, when some sort of collective decision-making for the league seems to have been institutionalized. The Lacedaemonians and their allies, which is what they tended to call themselves rather than the Peloponnesian League, would prove very influential in the next phase of the proceedings.
This ends Lecture 6. If you borrowed this course from a public library and would like your own copy of the course guide for future reference, call Recorded Books at 1-800-636-3399 and we'll send you a free copy. A shipping charge will apply.